Everybody, right. Can we come to this side and then we go that side? Gentleman there with the dark blue, is it?
Right, didn't even get a chance to think out what I was going to say.
Getting early.
The last lecture was...
Yes, you can hear.
On energy. The IMEC do a report on what energy we need and what our usage has got to be cut down to in 2050. And one of the things that struck me about it was it assumed that the rest of the world went on as before, that there wouldn't be any disruption to production abroad and there wouldn't be any refugees wanting to get into the country. And just thinking about the Stern report, you know, that's when that was written, it was a few years old. And things have got, the science has got a bit more pessimistic. But how much is the world situation taken into account by the government in present predictions of where the economy is going to go? Because I just think that it maybe neglects the fact that, you know, like if there's floods in Korea or wherever, then it's going to disrupt production of goods that we buy and the whole system will start to go.
Okay, thank you. Anne?
Did everybody hear that question? No? The question was, has the government taken into account the impact of climate change on production in the rest of the world? Is that right? Is that your question? And has the government calculated that? Disruption through disaster, through weather, extreme weather events. The answer, I don't know, is the answer. On the whole, I think the government, I mean, I've heard Gordon Brown saying quite bold things these last few days, and certainly Ed Miliband seems very concerned, and I must give Ed Miliband credit for that. I don't think we should patronize the government. I think they must know what you and I know. They must read the newspapers, is what I'm assuming. But, you know, what you and I know is not really well known around the population. So the government, I think, is very reluctant to move fast because they think the bulk of the population wants to stay where they are, wants business as usual, wants to go on their foreign holidays, wants to have their 4x4s. And in my street in London, it's packed with 4x4s. There's very few people there who seem to have any consciousness of either a crisis here or a crisis anywhere else in the world. And I think that's reflected in government inertia. But to be honest, I don't really know the answer.
There's a couple more people that indicated. Gentleman there with a beard and black fleece. Yeah, fleece.
Thanks. One of the main measures that economists seem to live by is as a measure of success, national success, is growth. Mm-hmm. Growth, it seems to me, is fundamentally predicated on consuming more and more resources, including our atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Can you foresee an economic system and an economic measure that doesn't fundamentally depend on that growth? That, in other words, a sort of a sustainable, steady state?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think Kenneth Boulding, who's a lovely new economist, was the one who said anyone who believes in perpetual economic growth is either bonkers or an economist. So I think the rest of us know. But actually, although we know, none of us assume that our living standards should ever fall. I have lived through an era, and I'm not young, in which my living standards have steadily improved, in which I have, you know, a technology now that my parents would only have dreamed of. And I expect that to carry on exponentially. And I can assure you that young people expect the new version of iPod out to be out whenever it's to be out, and it's to be faster and quicker and bigger and whatever than the current version is. The expectation of that isn't just something in the mind of economists, it's in the mind of every consumer. But no, it's deeply flawed because it assumes that our limited ecosystem is capable of constant expansion and is not limited. And actually that's extraordinarily arrogant and sort of man-centered view of the world. But it is also built in. I see that every economist and every politician and every trade union leader talks about how we need economic growth in order to get jobs. I don't believe you need economic growth, but I do believe you need economic activity. So what we have at the moment is the banking sector, and I blame the banks for this, have bombed the economy, if you like, and there's this huge crater of collapsed output and unemployment and losses and bankruptcies and so on. And it's like a huge hole. Now that and inactivity. We need to be economically active as human beings. If you put us in a hole and leave us there, you know, put us in a cave and lock us up, we go mad. If we don't have social interaction, if we're not socially useful, and if we're not doing things. But economic activity doesn't have to mean excessive consumption. You know, caring for the sick is a form of economic activity, and we don't do enough of it. We could do a lot more of it and not have economic growth. Educating our children. We could do a lot more academic research, which would not involve economic growth, but would be a form of economic activity. So I use the word economic activity because I don't believe that unemployment is a good thing. A lot of people are celebrating the collapse in trade that's led to the fall in emissions. A lot of people are celebrating the closure of King's North on the one hand, and then there's a lot of people who are saying, sorry, but those were jobs for me and my children, and they've been lost. And we've got to somehow bring those two sectors of our community together. That, you know, the Kenyans and the Africans who've lost out because we're no longer trading with them, you know, we have to think about that. Now, I don't think that we should continue trading in the way that we were before, but we've got to enable them to engage in economic activity, which isn't endless economic growth.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to be fair, I'm going to come on that side. Young man there with the jumper.
Hi there. It's a really awesome talk. Thanks a lot for that.
Thank you. That's high praise.
My question is about kind of what we do now, because the thing that struck me about your talk was the 250% debt that the UK was in during World War II. I personally believe there's a lot of parallels between World War II and climate change. It's an external threat that we can't deal with as individuals. We rely on the government to act.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you're proposing that the government just continues to go into, goes up to or beyond 250% debt in order to stimulate a transition to a low carbon economy.
Yeah.
Or if you're proposing more of a state controlled economy.
Right, okay. So the question is, am I proposing that the debt should rise to 250% as it did during the war in order to kickstart the low carbon economy? On the one, it was one bit of the question. Then it ended with this lethal thing about, do I believe in a state economy, or am I turning it into a state economy? Was that right? Yeah. A state-controlled economy. Yeah. Right. Okay. Number one. Yes. Now the fact is that if the debt does rise, you see, we're now in a globalized economy where money flows in and out of our country without any regulation or control. And the bond markets are now international bond markets. So the question is, will these invisible markets buy the bonds that the British government issues to finance its debt? And if the debt is at 70% at the moment, and the government has to sell bonds to raise the money to finance the debt, will the markets buy their bonds? Or will they say, sorry, we won't have these bonds? Or will they say, yes, we'll have your bonds, but we're going to pay, but you've got to pay 10% for it, or some very high rate of interest, you see. So the threat is that the bond markets will boycott the sale of government bonds and cause us enormous problems. Well, this was a threat in 1945 too, and Keynes said, we won't ask the bond markets for money, we'll oblige the banks to lend to the government, and we'll regulate the banks, and we'll insist that they lend to us at 1%, and that's what they did. And if the banks didn't like it, the government was willing to close them down. You know, we own Northern Rock. We owe 43% of Lloyd's. We could own a great deal more. We could be far more active in those banks and insist that they become servants to the economy, right? And that's what Keynes did in 45. And that's how they could afford to build the National Health Service. So, you know, we can make those choices. We don't have to be helpless against these international... Now, the other thing people are worried about is the price of sterling. Sterling will fall, people lose confidence in sterling. You know, that means inflation will rise because we import so much of what we consume now, because we hardly make anything anymore, that will push up prices and give us inflation. Well, the problem is that sterling is falling because our economy is falling. It's not falling because people are spiteful. It's falling because the economy is nosediving, you know. Now, if the economy goes up like that, I can assure you, so will sterling. So if we persist in pushing the economy down, we can be sure sterling's going down. Sterling will go up when the economy recovers, which is why government has to spend to kickstart the economy. Final question, no, I don't believe in state-controlled economy. I don't think the state can run small businesses, can sell gloves and scarves, but I do believe the state can control money. So I'm in favor, and by control, I mean regulate. I don't mean that we should have state-owned banks. I think the banks should be heavily regulated so that they lend sensibly tight but cheap money, and that they're not allowed to muck around and do what they like with us. But then let the private sector carry on as before, give them a break, you know. The fact is the private sector did very, very well in the golden age, it's called, from 45 to 71. And that's all I ask for, okay?
Okay, we've got a few more hands. Shall we come to the front here, Heather?
Thank you. My question is about the local economy.
Yes.
And like here in Sheffield,
right?
What thoughts have you got for us,
right,
about generating money locally,
yeah,
so that we can decarbonise our own economy and create lots of jobs?
Right.
There's things like insulating all our houses.
Yes.
54% of them are solid wall housing that needs a lot of labour.
Yes.
That's just one. There's also food growing, which would be really helpful.
Yes.
So there are lots of opportunities, but yeah, at the moment we need the money
do
that.
So the question is, what about the local economy, and how can Sheffield raise the money that it needs to revive its economy locally? Well, there are several ways of going about that. Number one, I think the government should funnel more money to Sheffield, because Sheffield has got the infrastructure here, and I'm so impressed with the new, the appearance outside the railway station when you now arrive at Sheffield. It's civic pride I see here. This is wonderful. Now, that was an investment, and it's so good for Sheffield. And clearly, Sheffield knows how to do that kind of thing. So I believe the government should be funneling money here on the first instance, you know, borrowing 1% from the bank, and then shuffling it through depending on the population of Sheffield and so on. So that's one way we could get money to Sheffield. Secondly, Sheffield could issue its own bonds. And my colleague Colin Hines was here the other day. He's very keen on bond issues. I'm slightly worried about them, because that's all very well if Sheffield can keep the interest rates on those bonds very low. Then that would be good. But that's to ask local people to put money into Sheffield, to invest it into the local community and make sure that it's invested locally. So that's another way you could raise finance. And indeed, Ken Livingston did this at the GLA, and I understand that Sheffield Council is considering issuing bonds here too. And the third way, of course, is to issue a Sheffield currency. Now, in Brixton, they've just announced the arrival of something called the Brixton Pound. And it's a piece of paper. You know, when the bankers entered money into a ledger, you and I didn't believe them. When they said it was in our account, we said, oh, no, you've got to show us. So people like to have you know, coins and notes in their hands. So what they've done in Brixton is simply print out lots of bits of paper, and they've been exchanged for real pounds. But there are two rules. The rules are that they can only be spent, those Brixton pounds, in Brixton, and they must be spent by a certain time. They've said their time limit is the end of next year. But a very radical experiment in Switzerland just after the war, they issued a currency which could only be spent in a local area, and it had to be spent within a month. So it was, do you remember you used to get co-op stamps and you used to be able to add your stamps on it? Well, they used to put stamps on it. And of course, there would have been a bit fiddling going on. But the whole idea was that you had to spend your money. You were given, people were issued a certain amount of this money, and it had to, they had to spend it locally. So what it meant was that as you got towards the end of the month, which was the limit by which you had to spend the money, you thought, oh my gosh, I better get the house painted, and I better have my hair done, and I better go and buy some carrots, because otherwise after the 31st, this money is worthless. And they issued a new one after that. And what that did was that, and within 3 months, they'd eliminated unemployment in their town. So a local currency can work, but you've got to get the currency right and the way it's managed. And you've got to also have some confidence in it. And I believe that the one in Brixton has, it, before they started, 60 shops had agreed to go in with it. And then it's now double that number. It's run by the New Economics Foundation. People are swapping and exchanging. It can only be spent in Brixton. So someone was telling me that someone delivered a pizza to their house the other day, and my friend said, I've only got a Brixton pound, but you're from Clapham. And he said, oh, don't worry, I take Brixton pounds, he said, because I've got lots of Brixton customers. So he put that in there, and he put his pound notes in there. And when he was dealing with his Brixton, so it's kind of leaking a little bit too. But the whole point is that the money is generating economic activity in that local area. But the thing I like is that you put a time limit on the spending of it and you force people into economic activity. Okay?
I'm going to move across to this side again. Gentlemen, right at the back. We're halfway through the time allocated.
Thank you for an inspiring presentation. I just want to thank you for putting a realistic edge on Obama's presidency, because I am from Chicago, so I have a bias.
Sorry, I can't hear you.
I am from Chicago. I live here in Sheffield, but I'm pleased that you've put a realistic edge on the hope of Obama's presidency. So okay. Thank you for that.
Yes.
My question is very local here in Sheffield. There's a company here who wants to build a biomass facility.
Yes.
And the issue is, what fuel they will use. My concern is that they will just, as the market tells them, they'll probably want to burn the cheapest one. And I certainly don't want it to be corn, like what happened a couple of years ago in Mexico with Bush growing corn for... Yeah. For fuel. So how can we come to a compromise with a company that may not care about what fuel they burn?
Right. I'm afraid you've got me flawed there. I'm not exactly an expert on biomass, but my instinct is that, and I don't want to sound like I'm in favor of state control here, but my instinct is that government has to start saying what is sustainable in terms of burning, what fuel is sustainable. But unfortunately, that's not my patch. Money I'm fine on. Biomass I'm no good on, really.
Mike.
Okay, so the EU...
In the past, the European Commission and have put some criterion, but... Just yesterday, there was a report from the United Nations that there's question to whether it really is a viable, proper
right.
criteria. They need to be changed because of the food crop issue.
Right. I mean, you're touching here on a very big and deep issue, the question of food and sustainability around food production. And really, that's not my patch.
But thank you anyway.
Okay. That's two people here, and then I'm going to call across there, and Jenny as well. Gentleman here with the short sleeves now? The sleeves are rolled up.
Thank you. You've touched on regulation. Government regulation as being key to what you're saying. Regulation isn't going to work unless it's made to stick. We've got the example, there was a program on the radio a day or two ago about how small the fines are on water companies and farmers for polluting rivers and killing a whole river, and they're fined £10,000. I've come across some ideas about regulating by doing things that can't be wriggled out of, such as granting licenses, and then your license goes defunct if you abuse the regulation. I think there was another idea as well, which meant that, in effect, your any business could refuse to pay you their debts or whatever it is. You know, you go out of business because of the way in which the regulation is enforced. Yeah. Could you expand on those methods, please?
The question is, you know, what impact will regulation have, and can you regulate effectively without businesses going out of going bust or without them trying to evade it in some way or another? You know, the thing is, I think it's deeper than regulation. I think it's about values, really. Now, throughout history, you know, we've managed to cheat and cavil and escape and get out of, you know, rules and regulations and commandments. And we've worked very hard to do that, you know. But when the commandments are clear and when the regulations are underpinned by real values, it becomes a matter of something totally unacceptable. So I think it's hard to regulate in a culture based on values where nobody cares a damn, where greed is a wonderful thing, where if you're prudent, you know, you're old-fashioned. And in those circumstances, it's very hard. Or if you're concerned about the environment, you know, you're a tree hugger. You know, we insult people who care about the environment, just as a matter of course. So I think it's you know, the Ten Commandments was about what you do about people who go around murdering each other. You know, will you lay down a commandment saying, thou shalt not kill? That doesn't stop them from killing, but you create a whole culture, a religion even, which makes it quite hard for them to kill without feeling a pang of kind of guilt, you know? And then eventually they may stop killing each other. And I'm very struck by this. And as we're here in the cathedral, I will sermonize on this because, you know, we used to regard excessive making of money from money and the excessive rate of interest as usury. It was a sin. You know, you could be excommunicated from the Catholic Church if you were a money lender. Your daughter would not be married in the church and you would not be buried in sacred ground. That made the money lenders a little uncomfortable. It made it a little difficult for them. They needed prestige in their societies and so on and so forth. So rather than stop money lending, they changed the church. So what happened was, after John Calvin and the revolution, the Reformation, the revolution that took place in Geneva, John Calvin said, well, actually, an interest rate of 5% is not a bad thing. Let a man make up to 5%. Of course, he mustn't be too harsh about it, and it mustn't be much higher than 5%, but 5% is okay. Now, before that, 0% was okay. And we lifted the lid on that commandment, if you like. And after that, you know, Geneva exploded and capitalism went ba-boom. In Islam today, it's still considered kind of bad taste if your daughter wants to marry a banker that makes money out of money. We don't think that in our society. We think, you know, your daughter's doing jolly well if she marries someone from the City of London. But in Islamic society, making money out of interest is known as riba. It's a form of usury and it's still condemned. Now, that's not to say that Muslims don't cheat, that Islamic banks don't cheat and get around it and they find all kinds of clever tricks to play. But the fact is, it stinks in their society. And we have no regard for this. We have no understanding of this. Whereas in our society, making money from money is a sign of success. If you do a PhD in physics at Cambridge University and you end up in the City of London, you are the most successful child in your family. If you don't go into doing research into physics and, you know, fine academic work, but instead you go to make money, you are celebrated. So I think we've got to change our fundamental values if we're going to get those commandments to stick and those regulations.
We
Well, that's... What? You see why I'm evading it? It's a difficult question.
Look,
I think we need political will.
You're not going
to
get...
And for that to happen, we need values to be
We are fast running out of time. We're well into the final 5 minutes. I'm going to take the lady in blue, and then, by coincidence, we're going to ask Jenny to do the final question.
I'd like to talk about opportunities.
Yes.
We talked about opportunity. In the past, there were friendly societies and organisations, mutual societies, that rose up amongst the poor to help them in their times of need. Why are there no people opening banks? Why is nobody opening friendly societies now for those of us who would like to take our businesses out of where they are and put them in somewhere else?
Yes.
What's happened to the market?
Yes. Well, we have the cooperative bank, but we also have credit unions, and I believe they will start flourishing now quite soon. But again, that's a spirit that will have to come out of a new set of values, you know, because the values of competitiveness are dominant. The values of cooperation have to be reinvented again, I'm afraid, by your generation and by you.
Okay. I mean, I could add something on that.
Yes, please do.
I mean, within the Muslim community, we often have something called the committee, where 20, 30, 50 people come together, and every week put £25 into the committee, and the one that needs it most takes the committee for...
There you go.
And then nobody ever defaults, because you're part of the extended family, the village where you come from. And the person that needs it least but needs the money at the end tells them, I want to be the last in the committee. And that way people continue. Often people don't go to the banks. And obviously, clearly gets around this issue that you spoke about with interest and it being haram. I mean, clearly there'll be people, no doubt you'll know many people that are, you know, not doing that. You'll say, but I know a Muslim friend who doesn't. But by and large, in those circles, that's where people are doing it informally. And you're asking whether that could be formalised. It's something that, you know, we could look at. It's how we get people to join it. Clearly, in some communities, it's happening. It's just not constituted. It's, you know, there's no rules, no bank accounts. People give money, take money.
Trust.
It's trust. But, you know, it does happen. Jenny, last question.
Thanks. Yeah, another pointer for people who want to invest their money in something worthwhile, Sheffield Renewables Community Supported Agriculture Projects will both be looking for investment in the near future, something you can invest to actually do something productive in Sheffield. That wasn't quite my question. It was about, I like the way you say, you know, a government can spend its way out of recession, and if the government spends money, it can get us out of the economic slump and get things going again, and that will be a positive way out of that. But I'm also very convinced, I've seen the graphs, you know, economic growth equals carbon dioxide, as far as I can see. So how do we ensure that the spending that happens to do that, what kind of spending, I mean, I suppose probably you're going to tell me the obvious answers, but how can we ensure that spending doesn't just lead to more climate change?
Well, that's going to be the tricky part, but I think, I mean, for me, that's where localization comes into it, really. We live in a global economy where the principle that drives the economy is competitiveness, that... you know, if we're going to insulate the homes in Britain, we've got to go around and ask, you know, the Japanese whether they could do it more cheaply than the Danes or the Americans, and then they're going to import all their kit across here and bring all their people over because they can work more efficiently than we can. Whereas actually, if you think of it in a localized sense, and you say, look, we're going to invest in what, I mean, I think the criterion has to be that the investment that the government makes has to be in productive activity, which doesn't necessarily lead to growth. I think that's not easy. You know, if you're going to insulate homes, you're going to have to need, I mean, I'm not a builder, but I'm assuming you're going to need materials and commodities. And that's going to cost in terms of, taking out of the ecosystem what you need for that purpose. But the whole point of it will be that once you've insulated the homes, you'll use less carbon and you'll start, you know, lowering your carbon. So these are decisions, I think, that have to be made within that framework of how, you know, when we faced the threat of Hitler, we invented something called rationing. And we decided what was important. And we decided the dukes and duchesses of this world couldn't have silk stockings, you know. We may well have to make those sorts of decisions again. But we have to, first of all, realize that we're facing a crisis, and we've got to get a government to understand that we're facing a crisis. So I'm sorry, it's another nebulous answer. But when I'm in government and I'm doing that, then I'll have to think hard. But at the moment, I have the luxury of not having to think of the detail.
Okay, thank you, Anne. I mean, one of the projects that Jenny talked about, I think there's a stall still up there and just a display board for Sheffield Community Renewables in there. So those people that are interested and want to invest in community projects, I'm sure there's leaflets there and probably people from that organisation. We are overrunning, but I still think there's another important issue that Michael wants to raise with you, and he's promised he's going to be brief. So, Michael.
December the 5th, December demonstration in London, train there the wave. It's important. There's a table about it at the back. Inquire about it. December the 5th matters. We need a lot of people there. Biofuels, you'll be nobbled by somebody on the way out saying, well, you've got to do something about that. So be prepared to be nobbled about biofuels. These lectures are called the Plan 2050 lectures, and they're designed to lead to action. And you will have seen the Plan 2050 flyer on your seat. And this is based on the remarkable book by David Mackay, which shows how we can put realistic numbers on how to build a low energy economy. And of course, the low energy economy is something which relates very closely to what Anne's been talking about. Because if you look at this book, you'll see that we need a huge infrastructure in order to get that economy. And it seems to me that we could actually employ people for several generations in building that low energy economy. And I have been hugely encouraged by what Anne's had to say this evening, because we really can say to our politicians, don't fuss around, produce the money, and get building that low energy economy. Now, part of that is that if that's going to happen, we have got to get the politicians producing the numbers. None of their policies actually produce the numbers. So Plan 2050 is very simple. It's about saying to the politicians, come up with your plans for a low energy economy, but give us the numbers. That's it. Give us the numbers. And so what we want to do is to contact all the candidates in all the constituencies in the UK, no small task, and get them to say to them, get your party to give us the numbers for your plan for a low carbon economy. And thus the parties will be forced, I hope, to come up with it. I think the campaign is likely to be highly effective because it focuses around two things, maths and the ballot box. And those things could make the politicians think. Now, we need help for this in two ways. One, we need people to do the hard work in the constituencies. So you can sign up at the back, and with luck, you'll find it difficult to get out without signing up. But please do so, because we need people, as many people in as many constituencies as possible, to nobble the politicians. So please do that. The other thing is, we need to spread the news about this simple, but I think could be extremely effective campaign. It's on this sheet here. What I want you to do is to email this round all your friends, relations and contacts, telling them to get on with it and do it. Now, if you all do that, it could mean that by tomorrow evening, 1,000 more people know about it. So please do it. Don't put it off to the end of the week. Do it tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
With that, I just want to personally thank Anne for taking time out to come up from London, extending the time that we agreed with her in terms of presentation, the speech, the lecture, and question and answer session. And I want to thank each and every one of you for taking time out to come here this evening. And I want to thank the organisers, all of you, for organising this. I'm not taking any credit for this. I've only been asked to come and chair it, and it's been a great pleasure. So once again, thanks everybody, and have a safe journey home.
people are going to say, you know, things are forbidden.